This episode of the Third Sector podcast is sponsored by Salesforce. And if you have 10 minutes of browsing time spare, you should check out their social impact center, salesforce.org, which focuses on partnering with the global community of changemakers.
Salesforce.org's unique business unit is dedicated to creating solutions for nonprofit, educational, and philanthropic organizations so they can have a greater impact. And they provide access to powerful technology that empowers changemakers to build a better world.
Hello and welcome to the Third Sector podcast. I'm Rebecca Cooney, Senior Features and Analysis Writer.
And I'm Andy Ricketts, News Editor of Third Sector, the UK's leading publication for the voluntary and not-for-profit sector. Each month, we're delving a little deeper into some of the conversations we've had in our community, learning more about exciting innovations and probing some of the issues we're facing.
This month, we'll be hearing about the voluntary sector's response to the Black Lives Matter movement and charities' efforts to tackle institutional racism and the lack of diversity within their own organisation. Third Sector's editor, Emily Burr, will be talking to Kunle Olulode, Chief Executive of Voice for Change England, and Saba Shafi, an organiser for Charity So White, about the steps charities have already taken and what more needs to be done.
We'll also be speaking to the newest member of the Third Sector team, senior reporter Stephen Della Hunty, about how charities should be talking publicly about their anti-racism policies.
And as ever, we'll be bringing you our coronavirus care package. Good things in the sector that have cheered us up this month. But first, we've got so many Third Sector editorial staff in this episode, it's more overstuffed than a post-lockdown donations bin outside your local charity shop. Andy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
How's your lockdown been?
Oh, well, you know, probably pretty so-so. I can't believe 6 months has virtually passed since we've been working from home. But I am very pleased that some things are starting again, not least a bit of live rugby, which I'm particularly pleased about. How about you?
Yeah, pretty much the same. Not so much with the sport, I have to say. That's not really my...
not so much your bag.
No, I'm glad you're happy, though.
And I'm certainly looking forward to getting back to the cinema when that finally reopens with Christopher Nolan's new big film coming out, Tenet. That's exciting. I'm kind of nervously anticipating the possibility of going to see a live film, although my favourite local cinema hasn't actually reopened yet, which is a bit sad. So let's hope that happens soon.
Yeah, no, I've definitely been missing live events, actually, I have to say. I do a lot of sort of going to see live poetry, theatre, music, not so much festivals, but I always like the idea that I might go to festivals. It's been a couple of years since I've been, but I like the idea of going to one. The possibility being there at least is a good thing.
It's always good. Now, you had a bit of a story, didn't you, about a festival that went a little in an unexpected direction?
Yes. So the lovely people at the MS Trust were just hoping to bring a bit of kind of festival themed joy to everyone's summer, with an online fundraising event called Coachella, which obviously is a play on the American arts and music festival Coachella. And but unfortunately that didn't happen.
What went wrong?
Well, so the event happened, but it had to happen under a different name because the company behind the American festival threatened them with legal action because they say they've trademarked the suffix Chella.
Right.
Which, like, I get it. Like, fair enough. That's you know, that is your copyright and, you know, you trademarked it. But, yeah, I mean, it's a £2 million a year charity and... No, but nobody was confused by that. Nobody actually thought that it was Coachella. An MS charity hoping to bring people a bit of comedy, some music, some poetry in their living rooms, a couple of dance classes, I think, and a festival that grossed more than $114 million in 2017. Thought, nah, you know.
It seems a bit harsh on a £2 million a year charity.
Yeah, I think stingy misers, basically, is my thinking.
What did the charity do in the end?
So they did eventually run it. They called it the MS Trust Home Festival. And I can't find any figures for how much they raised yet, but because it only took place last week. But hopefully it was successful and kind of best of luck to them with it, because they were just trying to bring a bit of joy and raise some money, which we know charities need at the moment.
Yeah. I'm wondering if I might be able to somehow trademark the suffix gate, because obviously in any time anything goes wrong or there's any hint of a scandal these days, people deploy the word gate, don't they, on the end.
So that is true. That's true.
Maybe this should be Chella Gate. I don't know.
perhaps, and then you'd probably have to donate them any money you got, though, I think, at this point.
That's true.
To the MS Trust for this particular scandal.
I think they deserve it.
Great. So shall we make a podcast?
Let's do it.
So on with Emily's interview, looking at Black Lives Matter and the charity sector.
When George Floyd was killed by American police in May this year, there was an international response to his death, which the political activist Angela Davis described as a global challenge to racism and the consequences of slavery and colonialism. A number of charities took to social media to share statements of solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement and make commitments to fighting racism. But simultaneously, conversations were being had about the institutional racism that exists within the voluntary and not-for-profit sector, ranging from the lack of diversity at decision-making levels to the micro and the macro aggressions that people of colour working in charities are subjected to. A lot of organisations have now come out to say, we must do better and we will do better. I'm joined today by Kunle Ololodi, Chief Executive of Voice for Change England, and Saba Shafi, an organiser at Charity So White, to talk about the commitments that are being made and how these might play out. So welcome, both of you. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Morning.
Thank you, Emily.
By the time this recording comes out, it will have been 3 months since the death of George Floyd. Now, while this is still incredibly early days, I'm interested in whether you feel there has been a shift in attitude when it comes to being prepared to act on diversity and more explicitly on anti-racism in the charity sector. Kunle, I would love to hear your thoughts.
I think that clearly George Floyd's killing was a catalyst for many things around the world and many institutions to respond, and not least within the charity and third sector. But I think, if I'm honest, the sector was ready for a discussion around this for some time, even before George Floyd occurred, even before our own report came out, Home Truths. I think there was a general recognition that in the way things were changing in other areas of British social life, that the charity sector on issues of diversity really was beginning to appear to be quite old-fashioned, and in many respects had fallen behind even the private sector. And so I think there were alarm bells. People started looking at things like our makeup of foundations. We started looking at why that in an industry where, for example, women predominated at the senior levels, most of them were occupied by primarily men. And in terms of questions of race and ethnicity, similar patterns of disparities were pretty much self-evident. It wasn't that we didn't have the data, it wasn't that people within the sector disagreed. In fact, I think there was an overwhelming recognition that there was a need for change. But I think that in terms of then acting on that knowledge and information, the sector was dragging its heels.
Saba, a number of people that I spoke to, including yourself, felt that there was a certain knee-jerk reaction coming from some organisations that was driven almost by a PR concern about how the organisation was perceived, rather than meaningfully engaging with these issues over the last few months. So I would love to know what you feel has kind of been taking place since May this year, and what the most important things organizations should be doing now beyond, say, posting a Black Square or a Black Lives Matter hashtag on their social media channels.
For sure. I want to echo perhaps like a lot of Kunle's points from before. I think I end up settling in a much more cynical place. Unfortunately, what I feel that we've seen in the last few months is that the charity sector, having had 10 to 15 years of preparation and knowledge and reports about the lack of diversity and in the sector, has now woken up to the fact that they need to publicly respond to some of these public incidents. And they have now a prepared and practiced reporting. Has any of that translated into material action beyond conversation is yet to be seen. And I think that for all of us who work in the charity sector, we see this time and time again. We spend a lot of our time in the intellectual world of understanding and collecting data and discussing what all the different things that we do and how, you know, the impact that they could have in like many years' time. And while that is important, it often steers us away from action, if not always. And certainly this conversation is not new to the charity sector. And the question that I ask myself is this the moment? Certainly we received, Charity Sir White received reports all the way through the international response to George Floyd's murder. And the responses that we were being told was that many charity sector leaders were talking about this in a frame of, you know, as soon as this is over, we can get back to the core issues that matter. That was the framing, that racism wasn't an issue, that it was a distraction. And that frame of mind, that treating this as a PR exercise, treating the incident and the discussions around it as something that impacts their public reputation, but not their practice, is part of the problem. And unless that is interrogated and resolved, the charity sector is going to continue to talk themselves in circles around this. Rather than posting black squares on the internet, Charity Sir White would have preferred to see a tangible list of commitments. That would have been, I think, a much more interesting, a much more bold, and a response that would have taken true accountability.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the you know, we are supposed to be the caring profession, very touchy-feely, and all the rest of it. And yet, when it comes to questions of race, it does appear that it's the presentation of what it looks like rather than the substance that actually is not being addressed. And I think that if there's one thing that perhaps is positive that's come out of this tragic death in America, is that for the first time, people are looking at the UK with perhaps more kind of eyes of scrutiny, and are really beginning to ask probing questions about how we can turn this from something negative into something more positive. And I do feel that the cynicism will always be there in terms of people using it as a PR exercise. But even if we can shift 20% of the organizations within the sector onto more solid ground in terms of doing practical work in relation to this, then I think we'll have achieved something quite substantial.
It makes me remember sort of back to like a year ago when Charity Sir White first started. One of the things that we asked the sector to do, it was a very small ask. We said, can you publicly acknowledge that the sector is structurally racist? And it was a curious, I think a lot of people found that ask to be very curious, because it wasn't about hitting specific recruitment targets. It wasn't about changing the way they use their communications. And I think the reason that we went down that route was very simple. It was to say that unless you understand that this isn't that there is a structural issue, that racism is real in the UK, it has a history here, it has in many ways a birthplace within the UK, that your actions, your planning, and your strategy is always going to come up short, because it will never take responsibility for something that it is part of in a bigger sense. And that was a very hard thing for charities to do, and be very open with understanding why. But I think the reasons why many charities have found that unpalatable I think speaks to some of the issues in our charity sector. We've had some very frank conversations with a number of organizations, and they say to us the same thing, which is that if we do this publicly, it will alienate some of the people who fund us. It will it goes against the idea of the sector and certainly the organization that, you know, we might be speaking to as a touchy-feely organization. And the thing that I keep coming back to is, what is the purpose of the charity sector? Is it about upholding that image, or is it about making like tangible, lasting change to those people who we are trying to support and trying to help? Because if it's about the former, then there's not going to be movement forward on this. But if it's about the second, then you have to make the hard choices today, even if that means that it feels like taking a step back or taking a hit today. The only way for charities to move forward and to get to a material shift is to be brave and to make that courageous step and say, actually, we care about lasting change. And that means we're going to admit to something bigger, and we're going to turn our heads to look at it square in the face and make the appropriate change going forward. And yeah, I think for me, it has to come from that place of bravery, that all or nothing, that yes, we're going to really grasp this and move forward. And if not, I think the movement forward will end up curbing background to either stagnation, as we've seen in the past with these conversations, or frankly back to the beginning where we started from.
Something that really interests me about what you just said there chimes with the Akivo and Voice for Change Home Truths report. One of the many very good practical recommendations that the report makes is that, you know, the sector works to redefine racism as ordinary, systemic, and institutional. So it's very interesting to me that, you know, again, we are seeing very, very similar calls happening a year apart.
I think that's a useful observation.
We're all asking for the same thing. It's not unusual anymore, right? It's not left field anymore. This is the same cry from across lots of different voices in the sector. I think the Home Truths report was a fantastic report. It's one of, I think, Ubeli's report that came out during COVID as well. The fact that 90% of BAME-led organizations in the sector were likely going to go under because of lack of support during COVID, I think is a damning statistic for the sector. I think lots of similar cries from like very different parts of the space.
Well, I was just going to add to that, that we have to be precise in terms of understanding what the problems of the sector are. We cannot just simply use blanket terms like systemic and institutionalized racism. Everybody at the moment is using these terms in a very, very loose way, I think. And we need to be able to pinpoint where within our sector the rigidity is within the institutions and where the discrimination is systemic. We also have to, I suppose, look at the historical legacy of a part of our society which is built on very paternalistic traditions. And those go back over several hundred years. So it's not just in recent times. And I think the legacy of that paternalism still exists. And at different points in time, it may have been seen as positive, progressive, but certainly today, it's not where we're at. And we need to be able to understand the historic development of our sector as well in terms of the attitudes contained within it.
One final question then for both of you. A year from now, what would each of you most like to have seen changed?
I would like to see organisations in our sector, and I mean that very broadly, not just charities, but also funders, also supporting organisations, all the institutions, the organisations within our sector, make a tangible move to put anti-racist objectives within their bigger priorities for the year. I'm not being picky here. It doesn't have to be, I'm not saying that this is about race versus any other line of difference, but rather than framing this as diversity and inclusion, to talk about what it means to interrogate and reflect on the way the organization is upholding previous practices and what it means to invest in changing that. So that means for me is money, resources, and also honest public communication so that they can be held accountable to the practices. For me, that would be a material, tangible action.
Yeah, I think for me, it's more complex in the sense of we're at the stage where we're looking at targets and quite hard measures in relation to questions of diversity and inclusion. But where we ultimately want to be is in a space where there's been cultural shift in attitude, so that the targets and the kind of hard measures that we're using become secondary, and that we're more confident as a sector that we're on the right course. And I think that that's probably going to take more than a year, unfortunately. But I'd like to think that there are some organizations that in a year from now, the seeds of change, of qualitative change, not just numerical, have taken root, and that they feel confident going forward. There aren't many organizations that have that kind of confidence around at the moment, but hopefully a year from now, we will have people who can stand up to scrutiny, but also not be afraid of talking about their failings and weaknesses publicly without feeling that they are, you know, being publicly shamed or having fingers pointed at them, but are really grasping the nettle of what organizational change really means in terms of both promoting diversity and having a more ingrained anti-racist culture within them.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
As we've just heard, in the wake of the renewed Black Lives Matter protests, many charities have issued statements pledging to do better in recognising and proactively combating racism in their own organisations and ways of operating. These statements have generally been well received, but how can charities make sure their efforts are seen to be genuine rather than jumping on a PR bandwagon or simply saying the thing they think people want to hear? As we mentioned in the last episode of the podcast, we've got a new member on the Third Sector team. Stephen Delahunty has worked on regional and national titles and most recently on PR Week magazine. So I'm taking the opportunity to pick his brains about how charities can ensure they tread the right PR path on this very sensitive issue. Stephen, hello. Thank you for joining us. How are you doing?
Hi, Rebecca. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. So we're increasingly seeing charities talking about how they plan to tackle racism, both within their own organisations and within society at large. So how can charities ensure they are being seen to do the right thing where it comes to race and anti-racism?
Well, I think I was actually quite surprised to learn the, you know, diversity in the sector is actually worse compared to the private sector. So I think before charities, you know, if they are going to talk about topics like race and anti-racism, they should really be putting, you know, plans in place not only to improve diversity internally, but then looking at other practical things they can do. Like, you know, I sat in on the Fundraising Everywhere's BAME fundraising conference recently, and again, I was quite surprised to learn that there's still a lot of talk about how fundraising materials reinforce ideas of white saviorism and, you know, aren't written in solidarity with or collaboration with communities that they're trying to work on behalf of. So I think, you know, those two issues there are some real practical steps that charities can take to be able to, you know, so they look like they are doing the right thing. Otherwise, you know, the statement is meaningless if they're not putting their own, you know, if they're not analysing their own practices and their own internal policies. And I think, you know, a third thing that they could do, and I think it was we had the Barnardo's boss, Javed Khan, writing something on the website this week about how, you know, bigger charities should be looking to uplift the voices of smaller BAME-led organisations. And I think that's really important because the you know, actual actionable things that charities can do now, so as they're not seen to just be paying lip service every time sort of these topics and these issues come to the fore.
So there's a gap kind of between how charities are perceived and kind of what the reality is, you think, and perhaps how they would like to be perceived and the reality. So they need to be walking the walk as well as talking the talk. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
So, I mean, is there a danger that such statements and kind of, you know, setting out these grand objectives of how they're going to do it can look like a soulless PR exercise, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, there's examples of it and you see it all the time across a range of topics. But I think, you know, one of the main ones that I was just, you know, looking at recently was when the campaign Nike ran with the American footballer Colin Kaepernick, who, you know, had been taking the knee during the US national anthem at American football games to protest against police brutality. And this had been going on for years where, you know, he wasn't getting any support from the National Football League either. And, you know, Nike was rightly praised, I think, for you know, running the campaign that it did and appearing to back, you know, his protest. But then at the same time, it was very easy for, you know, Nike was also getting called out because its senior leadership and, you know, only 10% of its senior leadership came from a non-white background. So it's very easy with the internet and social media these days for people to be able to look things up and, you know, call out some sort of hypocrisy somewhere and how your organization's, you know, how it's run or in terms of the work that it does. So I think you've got to be very careful when you're putting these statements out that your own house is in order, basically. Otherwise, you know, you're just going to get made to look a bit silly on the internet.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So apart from kind of Colin Kaepernick and Nike, are there any other examples you can think of where it's kind of fallen a bit flat?
Yeah, there was obviously the, you know, the Pepsi advert with Kendall Jenner that, you know, obviously was caught up in the Black Lives Matter protest in the US. And you had a whole, you know, range of civil rights leaders that were calling that out.
So yeah, so this was a campaign where it very much looked like Kendall Jenner was solving standoffs between police and protesters by handing everybody a Pepsi and smiling at them, I think was the...
Yeah, basically, and you know, and then you had, I mean, the, you know, Twitter was just full then of people reproducing other... There was one image that I found that was like a bottle of Pepsi in front of the tanks, you know, in that famous image from Tiananmen Square in the protest in 1989, so... It just spawned this huge, you know, parley on social media with people reproducing other images. And I don't know, the thing is, though, I feel like, you know, when you're as big as Pepsi, I feel like even they must have had this discussion, do you know what I mean? And thought even if it goes badly, people are still going to be talking about Pepsi at the moment. So I don't know how much sometimes these things are done on purpose because, you know, bad publicity is still good publicity, isn't it, at the moment? So I'd be interested to see whether, you know, Pepsi sales went up or down after that.
Yeah.
Because that'd be interesting. But yeah, I don't think there's any excuse, do you know what I mean, these days with these sorts of campaigns.
Yeah. So... With that in mind, obviously there's been a lot of pressure, I think, in the last few months for big organisations to be speaking out publicly and to make a statement and to be kind of, you know, drawing a line in the sand and saying where they stand on racism and on the Black Lives Matter campaigns. So what are your kind of top tips for putting together an anti-racism statement for organisations?
I mean, a very obvious one would just be, you know, I think the... You know, if your organisation isn't as diverse as you would like it to be, for whatever the reasons that they are, then I think the simplest thing you can do, and it's probably the only tip really, is just write it in collaboration, you know, with a BAME-led organisation or with a group that is involved in, you know, a movement or a protest or whatever it is, you know, get them involved and ask, you know, would they support it? Would they endorse the statement, or at least get their input? And I think that would be, you know, would be much more well received than just drafting something yourself and sort of, you know, posting it on Twitter. I think there needs to be much more collaboration with the organisations actually on the ground rather than just putting out. You know, you see it, a lot of these statements are often very similar and they come across as being like, you know, a bit friendly, but at the end of the day, you know, charities and especially brands and stuff are not really your friend. They ultimately want to sell you things or have another purpose. So I think to be sincere, yeah, they should be done in collaboration, basically.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
We were talking as well about, like, well, you know, the idea of apologising when people do get it wrong. Which I think we sort of touched on. But I think, again, it's like when you've got you know, organisations that do have big comms teams or, you know, in some cases will employ a PR agency to write things on their behalf. I don't think there's any, you know, I've had to wait weeks before for a brand to sign off on a press release announcing, you know, a new partnership with a comms agency. So it's like, where's the due diligence being done when you're going to comment on a sensitive topic? Do you know what I mean? If it takes 4 weeks to sign off that press release, where is the same effort being put into what, you know, could be a problematic statement or could upset people? It seems like a lot of these things are just rushed out to jump on the bandwagon when obviously there should be a lot more thought put into it.
Yeah. So something that involving the whole organisation then as well, and kind of really thinking about what's going on behind it and being prepared to kind of accept criticism and acknowledge where they're still learning as well.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, I mean, I can't really think of many examples where an organisation has, you know, put out a statement that wasn't received very well and then they've doubled down on it. You'd have to be pretty audacious, I think, to do that. But there may be some out there, but yeah, I don't think that's a particularly good look, is it?
Yeah, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for joining us and we'll look forward to having you on the podcast again.
It feels like it's been a long month, seemingly full of depressing news. For example, a report that 60,000 jobs are expected to go in the charity sector this year. So once again, we've come up with a list of a few or interesting cheerful stories that have caught our attention in the past month. What have you got for us this time around, Rebecca?
So first up was a fun little one that gave me some joy on Twitter. The National Trust decided to tweet the history of some of the objects in its collection that is connected to slavery and colonialism. So there's things like a little pot used to make chocolate, and obviously the cocoa and the sugar would have been, it was an 18th century pot, so that would have been farmed by slaves. The same with like sort of sugar shakers, that's not the same with little sugar shakers. There was some ivory, there was some mahogany that would have been felled by slave labor. And they were just talking about it and sort of saying, you know, we're recognizing this and we're looking at how we're educating people. And a few people on Twitter got very offended by this and said that they didn't like their enjoyment of historical artefacts being spoiled by knowing the history of them. The response to National Trust, I really like this one because I think it was sort of taking a leaf very much out of the RNLI's book from back last year. The RNLI took some flack from the Daily Mail for because 2% of its spending goes to teaching children to swim abroad.
Yeah.
And when the Daily Mail had a go at them, they just said, actually, we're not sorry. We're not sorry we save children. We don't care that you have a problem with that. And lots of people threatened to cancel their direct debits, which the same thing happened again with the National Trust. And again, the National Trust kind of said, well, this is the history of it. And I just thought they responded really positively to it and they were really brave about it. And I was a fan of kind of facing up to history and also not being cowed by people being a bit squeamish about these things or kind of using direct debit threats as a way of getting charities to say what they want, particularly as it's not clear that these people necessarily were members in the first place.
But it's fair to say there was also praise for the charity in terms of how they responded
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was a lot of sort of a very positive vibe towards them. And I think, you know, much like the RNLI case, it was a really good example of, you know, what sticking to your guns can do to you for in terms of your supporters and what they how they feel about you. So, yeah, I was a big fan of that. So what have you got for me, Andy?
OK, well, I've got something. If you've been stuck on your couch for the last 5 months, feeling maybe a little bit lardy, maybe a little bit bigger than usual, have a listen to this one. Kyle Gregg is aiming to raise funds for Chaz and the Gathimba Edwards Foundation by breaking the world record for the furthest distance run on a treadmill in 24 hours.
Wow.
Got any idea, Rebecca, of what the record currently stands at?
Ooh, I don't know.
24 hours running on a treadmill.
Running on a treadmill. Okay. Let's say 80.
80. Try doubling it. The official record set by Norwegian Bjørn Tore Kronen Taranga. Apologies for anybody Norwegian who might be listening. I've probably just completely mangled his name. But he set the record in 2018 and is 164.36 miles. Equivalent of 6 marathons.
I don't know why you thought that would make me feel better about myself sitting on the sofa, Andy. I'm not clear what the thinking was there, but that is impressive. That is very impressive.
I'll get to the bit that the way it would make you feel better about yourself, because I think that what this really shows is that, you know, despite everything that's going on and despite the hard circumstances that so many people are finding themselves in, this is still a great example of someone who's prepared to, well, quite literally go the extra mile for charity. So a massive good luck to Kyle, and he will be attempting to run more than 164.36 miles on the 28th of August.
Yeah, I mean, hats off to him and good luck.
Yeah, absolutely. What else have you got for us, Rebecca?
Okay, this one, I'm stretching the definition of cheerful a bit, but I think it's a great campaign, so I do want to talk about it. This one is Marie Curie, the end-of-life charity, are campaigning for a National Day of Reflection to help the nation grieve and remember all the people we've lost since lockdown began. So more than 1 million people have been bereaved since the UK lockdown began, whether that's a result of coronavirus or another cause, and we've just not been able to grieve in the same way that we normally would. They're proposing that the 23rd of March next year should be a National Day of Reflection. And this campaign is a little bit personal to me because it's being fronted by a friend of mine, Tyrone Lewis, in memory of another friend of ours, Dean McKee, who passed away very early during the coronavirus crisis. He was 28 and he worked in a care home, and he died of coronavirus, and he was a really lovely, kind, incredible, creative human being. And I think we've not really known how to grieve properly in this time where, you know, we can't see any of our mutual friends. Tyrone is fronting this campaign with Marie Curie, and it's a fantastic campaign. And I do think it's just really important that we do at some point reflect on our collective sense of loss and sort of remember and celebrate the lives of the people who've gone as we begin to heal from this trauma. I just think, you know, it's an excellent example of a charity saying, you know, what needs to happen and then going ahead and campaigning for it in a really innovative and interesting way.
Yeah. So when are they hoping to run that day?
So that's the 23rd of March, 2021. They're campaigning to be a National Day of Grieving and Remembrance and Reflection. And you can sign the petition at www.mariecurie.org.uk/national-day. So that's a campaign that's going on at the moment. I just think it's a great one. Andy, have you got another one for us?
Yeah, this one is a little bit different to that. This is about chickens. So there's a community interest company called Fresh Start for Hens that rehomes chickens that have kind of come to the end of their sort of peak laying period in their lives. Apparently, when they get to something like 72 weeks, I didn't know this, did you know this? When they get to something like 72 weeks, they kind of they're past their best in terms of egg laying capabilities. So often they just get sent off to be slaughtered. But Fresh Start for Hens, they take the hens and then they offer them up for adoption to anybody who wants a chicken and wants a pet in their garden. And the charity says that they've had more than 52,000 requests for chickens since lockdown began in March. I don't know if you remember, but apart from everybody having a real problem getting hold of toilet rolls, eggs was also another thing
that
you could not get for love nor money on supermarket shelves. And I think maybe that's part of the reason why they've had such a such an influx of people wanting to adopt chickens. But the charity that's run just by volunteers, I think, you know, usually just has a few hundred available. They said they were getting in 4,000 inquiries a week at the peak of lockdown. And, you know, I really want to avoid anything to do with a joke that might relating to chickens, but the service apparently is called Cluck and Collect.
Nice, nice. So,
there we go.
Yeah, well, that's that should ruffle some feathers. I'm really sorry. I'm really clucking sorry.
Yes, that was not a very excellent joke. All right, let's move on before this descends, before this descends into punnery of the worst form. What have you got?
I love a pun, and I'm not sufficiently ashamed of puns, I have to say. Yes, here is a piece of good job-related news. The Sure Trust has said it's going to create 600 jobs. They're a charity that deals largely with people looking who are unemployed. So the reason that they are increasing the number of jobs is because other people have lost theirs and there is a need for more staff to support them. But in terms of charity sector jobs, you know, the fact that a charity has the bandwidth to expand to meet increased demand in this day and age is a really, really positive thing. So, yes, well done to the Shore Trust.
Excellent. Shall I round off with the St Barnabas Hospice?
Yes, let's.
Readers might remember that St Barnabas Hospice a few weeks ago opened a drive-through donation service while its charity shops were shut. They operate 26 stores in Lincolnshire, and you can probably remember that people during lockdown, a lot of people maybe were having kind of Marie Kondo inspired clear outs, but they had nowhere that they could send the items. So St Barnabas Hospice thought, well, our shops might not be open, but we do have access to a warehouse. So why don't we start doing a drive-through service where people can come and give us stuff? They ran that service for a couple of weeks in early July, but now they've had to say that since they've started reopening their stores, they've had to put a temporary halt on donations because they've had more than 50 tons of stock donated to them in basically a month, which is a quite staggering amount of goods.
Yes.
I mean, I'm guessing they're probably benefiting from the fact that there are quite a few charity shops that are still closed. Most of the ones in my local high street haven't yet reopened. So I guess people are seeing if they're open. But I mean, it's interesting because when I spoke to the charity, and we did a story on this the other day, the person, the spokeswoman for the charity said that they'd been inundated, but in the best way.
Yes. I mean, I feel like that's going to be a lot of clothes or like 100 books.
Yes. You know? They don't say how many copies of 50 Shades of Grey they've received. Which, if I recall, has in previous years been enough to fill a small store on its own.
So, yes, I believe charities have said, please don't give us your old copies of 50 Shades of Grey. We have too many. I think that has been a thing in the past.
Indeed, but good luck to them while they sort through all of their 50 tons of donations. We'll be back with another episode soon, so make sure you subscribe to this, the Third Sector podcast, on your favourite podcast app to be the first to know about it.
Thank you to our guests, Kunle Olulode, Saba Shafi and Stephen Delahunte, to our sponsors, Salesforce.org, to the producer, Ben Lundsborough, and to you for listening.